to another episode of Sound Bites by Battery Ventures. Today, we'll be joined by Stephanie Buscemi, CMO of Confluent. Today's discussion is a very data-driven conversation, and we'll cover some topics like the importance of early indicator metrics and how they shape the outputs that her team delivers. We'll talk about Nail It and Scale It, a framework or concept of when a company is going from a single product gestation to introducing a second product. And lastly, we'll talk about storytelling as a superpower, the importance of having a great product marketer nailing your narrative inside the company. So climb aboard for today's session. Looking forward to diving in with Stephanie. I am your host, Bill Binch. I'm an operating partner here at Battery, and I wanted to welcome our next guest, Stephanie Buscemi, CMO of Confluent. Welcome, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you doing? Great to be here.
We have a lot to cover today, so I'm looking forward to diving in with you.
Sounds good. Looking forward to it.
Good. So just to set the table for today, Stephanie is a seasoned executive, pro-level marketer. She is, as we mentioned, the CMO today of Confluent. Previously was EVP and CMO of Salesforce. Prior to that, VPs at SAP, Oracle, some other companies. She sits on the board of directors of a few organizations. She's written a book, which are all topics that we're going to try and dive in and cover today. So why don't we kick that off with a little bit about Confluent, Stephanie? I think that might be a great place just to begin. Confluent has a pretty sophisticated motion. You market to developers. You have a PLG motion that helps do that. Yet on the other side of town, on the upper end of town, you also sell large enterprise types of deals. So I think a good lead-off place would be to maybe understand a little bit about your marketing org inside of Confluent today.
We're in the data infrastructure space, and we are a consumption-driven model. So I think that's an important thing. We are optimizing for consumption first. And even for me and my background, it was so much of it historically has been based on bookings and commits, and we have a fully based consumption model. So it's really great for the customer, you know, in transitioning to a cloud business in terms of having a model based on that. That said, I don't know if everybody realizes how much that upends and changes the way sales and marketing work. You know, your sales team, not to state the obvious, but your sales team is no longer incented on driving that big deal and then we'll figure out and realize customer value. It's from the get-go. It's all about everyone's in sales and marketing united around usage. So the role of we have both product-led growth and sales-led growth, and they're not separate. They work. They're deeply interconnected. So a portion of the business is, you know, that self-service product-led growth. And then there are some amount of sales-led, but the majority sit in what I would call this hybrid state, which is often the developer is starting with product-led, but they're sales-assisted. And the nature of the offering, it's a pretty complex offering, a pretty technical offering. And so you want to allow that developer to have as much time. The name of the game for us is how easy, how fast can we make it for them to go in and use the product and derive value from the product faster than them doing that in open source, faster, frankly, and cheaper than them doing that in open source. So we have a credits model on that. But then ultimately they get in there and there's so much more that they want to do. Typically, as you look in an enterprise organization, they're wanting to scale to multiple use cases. There's add-on capabilities that they need. And that's where I'm talking about the marriage of what the sales team comes into play. There is a volume business and there's a value business there. And it's really how do you instrument this hybrid motion of both product-led and sales-led together.
I think a lot of organizations are starting to look or are already going through that evolution. My last guest on the Soundbites was the chief business officer of Stripe, and she talked about the same transition that she had come from a classic subscription-based type of world and went into Stripe, which is obviously very payments-driven, which is usage-based, essentially, and went through that. And she talked also about the complexity of what it brings to both a marketing and a sales organization and getting those two to align and work well together. So consistent thoughts along those lines.
I'm really enjoying it because it makes ultimately, you know, we all say customer first and we want to delight our customers, it is all tied to customer value. And you know, you're no longer like trying to grow into some big deal. It's really about getting those workloads going with the customer and having them drive value. And then you get kind of a flywheel effect going.
Yeah, it's almost like everything's getting more micro. Like I was fortunate. I started my career in the old perpetual on-prem days and watched that become cloud and subscription. And now we're going through this transition of it to more consumption based. And it seems like it's more and more micro bits. But like you said, a very customer first mindset, not trying to go and jam the, you know, multi-million dollar deal that's going to last a few years into your customer's hands. Now it's about, you know, consume what you're going to use and just make sure we meter and get the pricing right for that.
Yeah. And it takes away sort of that awkward renewal discussion. Is the usage there or not?
Totally. Well, let's go. Thanks for covering a little bit of Confluent and also touching on the consumption topic, because I knew that was one that we were going to touch on today. Let's talk about another really fascinating area, which is the topic of being data driven. Very common term used today, but yeah. I'm going to take us back here. So your career arc, you've spent a lot of your professional time, fortunately, in analytics software companies. And clearly that's had an impact. And anything that I've seen presented by you, Stephanie, in our conversations, it's come across very clear that there's that data-driven element to your background. So can you offer some color on your experience maybe from those analytics companies and how it shaped you professionally?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very thankful to work for a couple data and analytics and dare I even say business intelligence. I'll be dating myself, companies out there, but they serve me really well because as you think about, as you come up with a business initiative or business proposal and the role of data in that and how it takes out a lot of the subjectivity, some of the emotion that goes into making business decisions. And I, at a pretty young age in my career, very early in my career, I saw the power of using data to run the business. And in particular in marketing, taking on leadership roles early in my career, I learned very quickly that marketing doesn't make it the product and we don't sell the product. And so we don't make it and we don't sell it. And so in my mind, in an organization, marketing has to attach itself to one or both and show how it drives value. And so for me, data was the answer to that. You know, while marketing has matured significantly in the last two decades or plus on how we use data, you know, I'm embarrassed to say I was there when it was impressions. Right. And people would just say, well, we'll get you this many impressions. And so for me, it was early on being able to go into a CFO or a CEO and be able to say, if you give me a dollar, what am I going to give you in return? And that just changed the entire conversation. It felt tangible, measurable. They understood when there were things that you're doing that aren't directly pipe generation, you know, there are things that are more thought leadership and awareness generation, you at least were clear about that. It has served me very, very well to be able to measure marketing contribution and be able to directly show that we are a driver of growth in the company.
All right. So you said a couple of things that I want to step back and double click on. First of all, anybody that's watched this show knows that I love me some frameworks, and you just laid one out there about I don't make it and I don't sell it. So I'm in this integrated middle right there. I love that model. I love that thinking. I'd love for you to play that out a little bit more, because I know you said you've had to align with both sides of it. I've had to go and align with the product team, which makes sense because marketing does exist right in the middle of product and the sales team. And then there's other times you've had to go align over on the sales team. So yeah, I'd love to unpack that a step further if you can.
Unpacking that a bit further in terms of looking into, you know, if I look into the product side of the house, what I love about marketing is I think when done right, you run the whole field. And what I mean by that is you should be with your product teams determining what is the pain you're solving for, what is your unique value proposition, and what are you building, buying, or partnering on? And then you should be able all the way through to that product launch, all the way through to that sales motion, and then that repeat customer cycle, be driving value on that. When I unpack it and look at it, it's what is the information that marketing is bringing to the table to the product organization? a lot of times I see that marketing organizations are just at the end of the conveyor belt, kind of looking in to go, oh, is a tire coming out and we're launching a tire? Is, you know, the wing of a plane? What is it? And I think that that is a miss. I think the more marketing's bringing data in that helps shape and feed in terms of what are you building? What are you building for? What is the unique problem that you're solving? So that's one to me on attaching yourself on the product side much earlier in the world of prod and eng. Do I believe marketing should play a role than I often see? And then I would say from the sales side, I think a lot of times a misnomer is marketing does pipe gen, and then marketing does its contribution to pipe gen. And I think the two failings of that, or the two misses with that, is one, marketing can generate pipe gen and say it's marketing attributed. You know, there's always attribution discussions internally in companies. But at the end of the day, if the company's not making the number, marketing should not be taking any kind of victory lap. Nobody's won there. So I actually look at it on the sales side of it is marketing has to, and I'm going to give you kind of another framework or way of I think about it is, you know, marketing has to be thinking about the volume of demand that is needed. We have to be thinking about the velocity and the way that demand gets prosecuted by whether it's direct or indirect, whether it's through your ecosystem, a direct salesperson, your product-led growth, the velocity in which it moves, and then what is the ultimate value to the company. So for us, it's consumption revenue. You have to be looking at all of those things and supporting all of those things. You know, I could just say I'm the volume, I'm the top of the funnel, and, you know, you guys, good luck with the rest of it. It's just not going to work. And so a lot of my team's time is equally focused on pipe maturation activities. It's focused on supporting all the teams that create pipeline. Marketing is not the only group that creates pipeline. I mean, pipeline is a team sport. How do we do it most efficiently, drive the highest volume and value out of it at the fastest velocity? Well, is it through partners? Is it through SDRs? Is it through PLG? I do think marketing needs to feel accountability for that and partnership with sales on that holistically, and not just be, hey, I gave you a bunch of inquiries or MQLs. We did our job. I think that's a failed mindset.
I think the best companies, the best performing, to be specific, companies, I think their marketing and sales leaders probably share a very common view of that. At Battery, we did a conference a little over a year ago, and I had Chris Degnan, the CRO of Snowflake, on stage, and he said at their board meetings, their head of marketing essentially comes in, and the core metric they talk about is, did the ship leave the docks with enough gas in it before we even got going? Did we create enough pipeline? And then sales talks about conversion rate of that pipeline. And it's a two-way conversation. It's not like a marketing section of the board and there's a sales section of the board. It's they come in and talk about how they're working together. And I think there's, number one, data-driven, the lead off of this discussion. But number two, I think there's just a precision inside of that, that like I said, right after he got off stage, another CMO got on stage and said, yeah, what he said, what he talked about, we do the same thing inside of our organization, which I think is just such a refreshing change that the marketer is not just viewed as the arts and crafts person in the room, right? Like you talked about this, you lived back in the day of impressions, you go back 15 years and it was like this marketer trying to scream above the rest of the teams to say, I swear I'm adding value and contributing to revenue. And I think over the last 15 years or so, we've gotten much better at being able to be objective in measuring that and being able to demonstrate that impact that marketing makes.
Yeah, and instilling that mindset in your marketing organization. You know, I've sat with different marketing teams where, you know, they're like, well, we don't control the sales cycle. By the very same token, the salesperson could say, I don't make the product. We could all do that all day long.
Right.
And so I think it's putting that mindset in the team that we run the whole field. You know, we never are just passing the baton and done with our work.
I think you're coining a good soundbite here, which is the name of the program, the Running the Field, because I've heard it twice now, and I really like it. It reminds me of, I have a former colleague of mine who was the CMO at Coupa, and he had a really great soundbite on this podcast where he said, the thing I don't want to do with marketing is show up to a board meeting or show up to a sales meeting or something like that and talk about the engine room. I don't want to talk about, you know, all the leads to MQLs and that type of stuff. He's like, because those are inputs. He's like, what I really think the marketing team needs to focus on and we need to get aligned on with sales is, like you said, the output. And so I love the analogy that sales could always like wave off, say, I didn't make the product. You know, everybody could say that, but that's, again, to me, not the mindset of a winning team. Really like that. So Stephanie, staying on data-driven, I want to take us back again about 15 years when you co-authored a book called Driven to Perform. And we've used data-driven a couple times so far in this podcast. I think that's a very common term, but that really only started up a few years ago. Like this is 15 years ago, and you wrote a book that was specifically focused on the novel idea of being data-driven in using that as a metric to drive any function of business. So I'm curious, how did you tune into that? How did you tune into that so long ago to where you would think about objectively measuring marketing that way?
I was at data and analytics companies. And so the value proposition that we were actually putting out into the market was the value of data and insights, and how are you using them to make business decisions? And how easily are you able to bring your data together, your disparate data sources, and do that in a way where you're getting meaningful insights that can actually impact the business, not in sort of a rear view where you're just staring at in the rear view mirror, but more prescriptively, proactively. And so because I was actually at companies that were doing that, I immediately, the way I learn is I'd say, well, then how would that work for me in marketing? And impetus for writing the book was really the notion that pretty simple concept that we all have to do some amount of report, analyze, modeling, and planning, whether you sit in the finance organization, in the HR organization, in the IT organization, in the sales, you are doing some amount of reporting, analysis, modeling, and planning. And I started to overlay what is the role of data in doing those things by function. And not only within the silo of each function, but then how do we converse with one another cross department to get shared insights? So the whole impetus of the book was to basically take performance management and say, look at, everyone has to do report, analyze, model, and plan across their businesses. You're all doing it in disparate ways. You don't have a lingua franca for how you do that. You need that across teams. And let me help contextualize for you how you would do that, one within each of your departments, and how would you then talk to the person if you're in marketing, to sales, to finance, and do that. So I always say to people, I've only written one book, and the Mark Twain saying, like, I'm going to mess it up, but, you know, I didn't have enough time basically to write you a short letter. That applies. The book is too long, if I could be critical. But what I will tell you is read the first pages, the first chapter will basically say, if you believe that you have to do a certain amount of, you have this closed loop of report, analyze, model, and plan, and you have to do that across an entire enterprise and how you do that, I then contextualize how you would do that by each area of the organization and what is the connective tissue. So that's the cliff notes of the book.
Got it. Going back in time and looking forward to what was to become, I think, a very common model of how people are going to look at functions and look to measure them. I want to stay on the measuring for one more question. I want to bring the people element into this because we've talked about objective, non-emotional, we've talked about data-driven, but there is still people in this. So I want to get to that in a second. But a common question that I get asked a lot is, for a marketing organization, what are the key metrics that you do measure the team on? What are the key things? Because like you talked about, like you go back in time to impressions, you could go to the MQLs, the leads I talked about, you could talk about pipeline. You go all the way down to close one business. So there's a wide variety of things that you could look at. I'm curious, what are the key you know, Desert Island dashboard metrics that you would pay attention to?
Yeah, so I have a set of what I would call early indicator metrics that tell me if we're on the right path to close, you know, to hitting our consumption revenue. So my early indicators are things like inquiries. Am I getting enough top of the funnel interest? And to me, that's nothing more than a suspect. I don't even know if it's a prospect. Then marketing qualified leads. So, okay, yes, they are the persona they want. They are within our target accounts, all those things that we want. Then I'm looking at hype generated, as you know, and I'm looking at that handoff to the sales organization. Very traditional. I think it's a lot different now at the level of detail we do that, though. So, for example, we carry a new logo target. We carry an expansion. We carry a geography, if a country level. We carry a product level. So we're really having to ensure the total health of the business. And I've seen many times where marketing makes its number again on milking the install base, but isn't really meaningfully contributing to new logo. And so while it may seem a bit excessive, the number of key metrics that we have, it's important because I don't want to be in a situation where we're just milking the install base and we're not really doing the hard thing, driving new logo acquisition as one example. Or I don't want it to be, you know, we're posting a global number, but we're really just making the AMER number and we're not in a meaningful way growing our international countries. Or another reason for having the level of detail is new products. You know, there's a tendency, you know, fastest path to PG is the fastest path to consumption. Oh, we're just going to keep pushing what we know. Well, a company right. that's at a place right now that's going from single product to multi-product and building that multi-product flywheel, it's of critical importance that I get the marketers to invest in those new product areas. And it's harder. It's harder to meet the targets on those. There's new personas, there's new content, there's enablement with the field, all of that. So that's why I get down to that level of granularity so I can go, oh, we're not just making a number, but we're actually looking at the overall health of the business across our product lines, our geographies, our balance between new logo, growth, and expansion. So that's one, and I know that was long-winded. That's one part of it. Another is, are we doing it most efficiently? So the example would be, you know, what if that should be coming out of product-led growth versus what if that should come out of a more traditional MQL model? So we have MQLs, marketing qualified leads, but we also have PQLs, product qualified leads. And in my example, we're multi-persona, but one of our personas is the developer. In my mind, proven time and time again, the fastest path and the most efficient path is not to send them, you know, the old saying, it takes 7 to 10 touches to convert to a lead in B2B. I don't need to send a developer, you know, a bunch of offers. I need to get them straight into the product. And then the product qualified lead needs to be all behavioral based and trigger based. What are they doing in the product that gives me the intel to have that next best action in the product experience for them and keep them moving to usage? So there's also efficiency and ROI metrics in there for the team.
Wow, there's a lot here. So first of all, just my reaction, I'm a big fan of forward-looking or predictive type of dashboards. I find that a lot of metrics that we track are good for telling me what happened, but they're not as helpful for me helping me instrument where my business is going to. So I like the early indicators. The four big ones that you gave, though, on measuring impact, though, of new logo, expansion, geo, those first three are pretty obvious to me. The product mix one is a really interesting one. And you said I think the operative word here is a single product company moving to multi-product company. I spend a lot of my time inside a battery helping our companies think about growth. Growth. It's a pretty simple word, but if you think about SaaS software companies, where they tend to grow is changing segmentation, changing geographies, and then becoming multi-product. The first two, I won't say are easy by any stretch of the means, but they're well like trodden paths that the organization have gone through. But the product piece is tough because, like you said, the sophistication changes. Suddenly you've got to be, as a marketing organization, earlier with your R&D team, understanding what's this product going to do? Is it additive? Is it its own standalone product that is a new entry point for me? You've got to be thinking about your own organization of acquisition marketing versus expansion marketing. And then you've got to be thinking about all the enablement and the training downstream to the sales team and to the CS teams that are going to have to be able to go sell this. Added by which you threw the complexity on top that there's the PLG motion and then the more classic MQL motion. So there's a lot there. I guess my statement here is going back is I really like the instrumentation of the early indicators as well as the outputs there. And then I'm kind of in awe at the metricing of the complexity of Confluent going through the single product evolution to becoming a multi-product or platform type of company.
It's exciting. I mean, I wouldn't want to be anywhere but a platform company. And this has been a very exciting part of the journey over the last three, just seeing where the product maturity has gone and the pull from customers as well, like is very validating.
Got it. That's great. I mentioned talking about the people element and bringing that in here. Everything you've said, Stephanie, to me as a former revenue leader is really refreshing because a lot of revenue leaders feel like they're the team that go into a board meeting or go into a weekly staff meeting and have the very clear pass-fail type of scorecard. And so listening to you speak about the organization there, to me, I would say, I'll bet you the sales team inside of Confluent is cheering this on, but do you find that this is a shift for the marketing organization, for people coming into the organization to come in and have this type of precision and clarity on what they're being measured on?
Yes, definitely. There is a population for sure. I would say the biggest thing is most marketers, B2B marketers, are still mostly on the sales-led motion. So the product-led, the importance of the product-led piece, that takes some education and ramping. You know, I'll get some people from within the space, you know, within data infrastructure who have familiarity with consumption and product-led growth. But I'd say the majority are still more from a sales-led motion, where it's a more traditional motion where, you know, they want to create, you know, a handful of offers. They want to do those offers. They eventually want to see how many offers it takes to get someone to convert into getting them to really treat PLG as a first-class citizen and challenge a marketer to say, why would you do those seven offers? Why aren't you getting them to the product? Especially when you're talking to someone like a developer who frankly doesn't want to be marketed to, they want to tinker. They want to play around with it at the product. They want get them to value faster. So I think that is still something that in B2B marketing, there's more room for growth in terms of marketers having that skill and appreciation for it. And then how to evolve that into a mix. And then how do you think about that as an and, not an or? And what I mean by that is when you're going into enterprise accounts, you're trying to court a whole bunch of people in that account. So yes, you're trying to earn the hearts and win the hearts and minds of the developers, but guess what? Like, you also have to be winning the hearts and minds of the tech executive to make a shift to a data streaming platform. And you have to be reaching line of business executives. You know, so if you think about real time and data streaming a lot, you can think about in banks, a very popular solution that we help solve for is fraud detection. Well, there's heads of fraud detection than any bank. It's a very big part of the business. Being able to go in and also have the the understanding for that, how they're thinking about it, the business value proposition, not just the technical offering for the developer. We have to, it's a multi-prong approach into the account.
No question. There's just a lot here. Like what it leads me to think about is sometimes I meet with companies that have started their whole inception of the organization as a PLG company, and they're doing the transition to going sales led, right? I'd analogize that kind of like to a company that started as an SMB motion and then moves up market, right? Yeah. Like there's a whole new skill you have to lead. And then there's the other way around, right? Like some companies start as enterprise companies and move down market. And what you just mentioned there has some similarities to that, which is how do you take an organization maybe of past sellers that have experience of doing these great big enterprise deals, but teach them how to get out of their own way to be able to, like you said, get the developer into the product. Don't get them to want to have a conversation with us because, as you mentioned, it's hard. It's hard to market to developers. It's hard to get them to want to get on the phone and chit-chat with a sales rep. And so it's a really interesting learning to think about the balance between your classic sales-led motion as well as the product motion.
Yeah, and integrating them. You know, I think there was a time where everyone felt like, oh, product-led. And then a CEO might say, I need a product-led motion. And you do have a real honest conversation with you. Can your product be bought, not sold? You know, and I think there's sometimes product-led initiatives out there where they haven't even really proven that. And then they're running into challenges there. The other is, you know, once you take it up market to your point out of SMB and you get into enterprises and the way enterprises buy, you are going to introduce sales-led. So right. you better plan for at a minimum a hybrid motion. And how do you instrument that in your go-to-market? What are the handoffs of that in the organization?
So let's talk about that, because prior to this call, you and I talked a little bit about, and I'm shifting to org structure topics here. Most companies start, most cloud software companies start with one product that they sell to one geo and probably likely one segment, either small biz or mid-market or enterprise in that, you know, in their ICP. And as they mature, they tend to introduce things like new products. Now, you, Stephanie, sit on the board of some smaller size companies, so you probably see this in real time happening. And likewise, you also had some experience in your background of where some of your past organizations were primarily single product led and then introduced another product. And all of a sudden there was this dog pile, I think, as you called it, of let's go. I'll try to sell everything to everyone right away. So share a few thoughts there. Like I said, about, you know, if you're thinking about a smaller company that's going through that transition to add products, how you'd help advise them.
Yeah. I mean, I've been on that journey a couple times, and I can say I have some scratches and lessons learned from it. I think the biggest thing is having a really strong understanding or a shared point of view in your company about how that buying and consumption of that product is going to happen in an account. What is the sequencing of things, the natural? So, you know, I'll give an example at one company where, you know, you basically would go in and we were selling them dashboards, you know, analytical dashboards. And so they wanted dashboards, they wanted executive dashboards, they wanted all these dashboards. Well, the dashboards were built. The natural thing without fail within 12 to 18 months was to go back and sell them a data bring in our data management offering, because the moment you gave them the dashboard was the window to tell them the data was bad. So there's, you know, that's a pretty simplistic one, but it would take sometimes standing up some bad dashboards for people to realize all the issues with their data. And then it was like, oh, well, we got to go fix the garbage in, garbage out. And I think that holds true in terms of how do you sequence what that experience is with the customer. So if you're going into the customer, a lot of times new products get created. And the way organizations do is they set up teams and they say, there's a quota on this new product, but the sales team doesn't carry it. The AE is product agnostic, And then very often you see people put overlay teams or specialists. Those teams are competing with one another within the organization. They're trying to get the AE's mind share. That's what I mean by dogpiling. And it isn't a great experience for the AE. It isn't a great experience for the customer, because there's almost internal competition versus saying, actually, we think this is how it unfolds in an account. This is, and we're going to be, our go-to-market motion is going to be prescriptive on the sequencing of things and how we create demand and how we do cross-sell and upsell. I would see people, even when I was back at Salesforce, massive growth during my tenure there. Went from predominantly sales and service when I came in to commerce and marketing and MuleSoft and Slack. And, you know, that the AE was in a quarterback role, but the AE was being, you know, you get bombarded with a lot of things. And so how do you sequence what goes first, what goes second, and then how do you do that? And then another piece of it is, don't try to do it across the entire field organization at once. Nail it and then scale it. I think all the time it's, we want to do this, and then we say we're going to, you know, enable the whole organization before we really have proof of life that something works. So I cringe when I see that. I think it's better if you can get a cohort of, frankly, a cohort of salespeople that you know are already really good. And get the wins with them. And I always look at it like, when you have an add-on, it's get 5 accounts, get 15 accounts. When you get to 50, put it into the mainstream.
A great model. Like I said, I love frameworks and schools of thought for thinking about that. How do you apply that, Stephanie? Like I said, you sit on boards. I'm sure you have friends that call and ask you for advice and stuff like that. Obviously, we're talking about Confluent and Salesforce, different end of the scale on size and complexity. But like I said, going back to like some of these companies you're on the boards of that are now just starting to introduce maybe their product B, like is the first add-on product that they're having. How do you guide those organizations on how to think about, number one, metricing all this, because obviously you're very focused on the data element, but also putting it out into the wild through your nail it and scale it paradigm?
Yeah, I think a couple things are really important. Is one, you know, you can say, oh, the viability and feasibility of something. So what level of complexity under the feasibility axis is, are you introducing into your organization to sell this? Like, does this require new personas? Does this mean new geos? Does this mean new industries? What skills are required? I would argue, a sales product add-on to Sales Cloud, much easier than introducing analytics for everyone. And selling analytics. So I think you have to be thoughtful about, am I asking them to go back to the same person, or am I asking them to go elsewhere in the organization? And how hard is it going to be for them to cut across the organization to go to this different persona? That's one. The second is, where's the power, frankly, in the organization? A lot of times the add-ons may make you stickier in an organization, but sometimes it introduces new personas that aren't necessarily going to take you to more strategic relationships. They're important add-ons, but how do you get higher in the organization with your value proposition? I think the more add-ons that you have, you need to ask yourself, like, are these things mission critical to the business, or are they peripheral and they're going to make you stickier, but are they kind of core versus context to the business? And so that should inform how much you want to put into that and invest in that, in your marketing, in your sales, in your acquisition cost, how you do that. So I think those are some key things that you need to think about when you're doing your add-on products.
That, Stephanie, was like a masterclass in 90 seconds or 2 minutes or something like that. First of all, I don't think you'd have to argue long, because I do think you said you'd argue that thinking about the new persona and the new geo. I completely agree with that mindset. I think that mature organizations realize that if we're going to jump the shark of who our core buyer is, or person of power, the second element you brought in there, that's going to be the economic buyer, that's where we have to think about our org structure. Does it make sense to have one rep that owns everything? And I would submit that an immature sales organization would argue, no, I want to keep it and just have one rep own the account.
For sure.
And I don't know, you look at like the great companies that have scaled to be public, that have scaled to be past $1 billion, and you look at them and you note there's a commonality. They have multiple sales forces that probably call onto the same customer. And then that helps you think, well, what do they do around marketing upstream, and what do they do with the customer team downstream? There probably is some similarity and alignment that they had to do there. So thank you for that. I think that was an outstanding couple of minutes of just listening to your thoughts on how you'd guide a small company, which is a lot of the listeners of this show. Let me ask you one last question in the org structure area before we tackle a couple other quick topics, but this is a learning and development question for you. You've, like you said, grown quickly in your marketing skills and in your profession. If you were the head of marketing at a smaller or early stage company, because this happens all the time, you're limited by the amount of resources that you have, and you as the marketing head come from some background. Maybe it's you're a great product marketer, maybe you're a great demand generation marketer, some specific function of the marketing, the overall marketing business. When you go to hire people, what do? Do you hire people that are better than you in other areas because you know you can always over-rotate back into that core area you do? Or do you go and look to hire experts in those areas that you're already great at so that you can go force yourself into these other areas and make sure that those are operating all right? I'm curious. I'm always curious from a functional leader's perspective of how they think about building their teams when you have limited resources.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a really important question to answer for. I think in a smaller company, let's say you've established product market fit, to me, being able to have your strongest marketing hire be somebody who is really going to develop and own and evangelize the narrative of the company. Oftentimes, I've seen that gets crafted with the founder and the CEO, and as it should. And then a marketing team gets hired and they're doing tactics. And yet those two things haven't really come together. And I've a lot of times, whether in an advisory capacity or what, I've talked to startup CEOs who feel really frustrated. You know, my marketing stinks, you know, they don't understand the business. They don't understand the offering, or they're doing stuff and I don't know why they're doing those things. So, a super strong, every role in marketing matters, but like if you don't have a strong product marketing leader, overused term, but storyteller that has super clarity on like a really compelling story that's differentiated, and that person that story can like galvanize, it can rally the company, it can excite the investors, it can bring all the team together, that you are missing a foundational piece. And sometimes I see people have like investor decks where somewhat of the story, the early story, is there, but there isn't further narrative development and story positioning and messaging work done. And then they're hiring tactical channel marketers. Like they jump immediately to, well, I need leads. And you get a bunch of people doing tactics. So for me, it's really, really important to make that product marketing hire a strategic hire. It's critical because they, if done right, they inform the campaign strategy. They inform the channel and tactics strategy. I also think some of the channel marketing tactics, not all, But some of them, if you have to, if you're, you know, budget constrained, some of it in the early days, you can outsource that. You can outsource some of that. You can do that, right, and get more contract resource for that if you, you know, you don't want to be carrying as much headcount on the books and all of that, and give yourself more flexible, more flexibility, that more of your budget sitting on discretionary than headcount. And I think that works well.
Got it. Storytelling as your superpower is the line there. I think that's a great perspective. Thanks for sharing that. Let me shift to generative AI, which is obviously growing in its importance and popularity right now. I think, Stephanie, if you look at some just transitional moments in modern marketing over the last 30, 40 years, obviously the introduction of the internet was huge. Mobile was a huge one. And then you look at today with the introduction of generative AI and the impact. I really see really two areas that I think generative AI has large impact inside of a marketing function. Number one is clearly on the positioning that we just talked about there, the storytelling. We're seeing already, you know, people talking about fakes, deep fakes, all these things, but also a lot of the good that's coming from it, of how much time it's saving people to go be able to build a narrative. And then secondly, aside from just the positioning side, there's the workflows of how we think it could impact our functions that we run. Sales, there's a lot of places where we see generative AI. Love to get your thoughts around those two areas, around the impact of Gen AI overall inside of marketing, but specific to positioning and into internal workflows that you have.
Yeah, I mean, I use it every day, and I think it's just going to get better and better and better. We have a team that, and I know many companies are doing this, but to really look end to end at what are all of our marketing workflows and challenge ourselves to say, like, where are all the places that we can leverage Gen AI? I would definitely, you know, caveat it that it's early innings, but there's a lot of excitement around it. And I think the excitement to a marketer is, frankly, they can work on more high value tasks rather than the repetitive stuff that Gen AI, you know, automates a lot of tasks and gives them time back and makes life a little bit easier. Key areas, probably somewhat obvious, but is one in positioning messaging, two in content creation. There's some really cool companies out there. Like when you think about creating videos, you know, used to have a ton of production team, video team, expensive. You know, I'm not doing commercials for others, but like HeyGen out there, I mean, totally changing the game on how you do video creation with Gen AI. That stuff allows the marketer to focus on the core positioning and messaging, and then be able to do all those other things around how are we doing text better? How are we doing video creation better? Be able to do that with all of those tools there. So I think it's going to automate a lot of repetitive tasks. I think it's going to allow people to focus on more high value things, which is your positioning and messaging and your narrative. I do think it will actually help be a brainstorm partner in your positioning and messaging. So the ability, if you think about, you know, as cliche as this saying is, but like it holds true, right message, right place, right time. It being able to ensure at the time where people are asking the question, at the point of the prompt, at the point of the inference, being able to push the right information, like it changes the game in terms of what we're able to provide. And then the insight we're able to get back on that and feedback into our positioning and messaging. So I'd say it's going to give a lot of wins on personalization and being able to do all of that much faster than we've ever been able to do before.
Yeah, it's great. I was speaking with a battery portfolio company whose headquarters is in Israel, and they had a really skilled product marketer there that English was a second language, and his product marketing skills were great, but the obvious challenge was how does he convert that into something that's for a, you know, North American audience, for, you know, majority of their buyer audience. And as opposed to going through a more arduous task of giving it to another human being to do it, they're utilizing Gen AI to be able to make that, or I guess he was doing it by himself. And so the head of marketing was telling me that you know, she recognized him for being a great product marketer, but that the language was an inhibitor. And all of a sudden, one day, it just changed. It changed that fast, that distinctly. And she said, what happened? And he had found a tool to be able to use to synthesize what he was saying in his language and convert it into to English.
That's a phenomenal story. And by the way, that marries pretty beautifully as we look at so many of us in tech are hybrid or remote first, where, you know, best talent wins. You know, at Confluent, we're a remote first company. I'm hiring around the world, and being able to get to great marketers, but then marrying, you know, dealing with the language differences and having those tools. I think there's tremendous amount. We're just scratching the surface on analyzing text, images, and videos. Okay. And what we're seeing there to uncover new campaigns for personalization. We're just, in my mind, we're really just getting started on it.
Me too. You said early innings, and I think that describes it. Stephanie, one last topic to hit on. I think it's a great place that really ties a lot of our discussion today is around confluent.org, which is another one of the boards that you're on. It's your company's nonprofit. I think when we talked about data-driven, that was a key topic for today. This is an organization that is very data-driven. I'd love for you to end our session today by sharing a little bit about confluent.org and how the analytics and the data focus contributes to actually the purpose of the organization of lives saved.
Yeah. Thank you for asking about that. So one thing was, you know, for us, we said we want to be profitable before we start Confluent.org. So now a profitable company and initiated and started Confluent.org. We believe in, you know, giving back in the communities that we serve as a company. But we had to put a lot of thought as a team, you know, that could mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. You know, are we going to chase down every issue out there? Are we going to try to serve every nonprofit out there? No, we're not. We didn't feel that that was an effective use of our time and how we go about and do this. And so we are a very data-driven company. And we took a step back and we said, we want to make the biggest impact with every dollar that we give out into a nonprofit. And how will we do that? And we did a lot of research about it. And we identified with this company, nonprofit GiveWell. And I would encourage anyone to look into GiveWell. They're a nonprofit, a charity. And what they do is they're basically an effective altruism organization that goes in and assesses nonprofits around the globe. And the way they're looking at them is they're evaluating them with a very data-driven approach to say, what is the cost effectiveness of the organization and the value that it provides? And so they measure lives saved with their organizations. So they look and say, you know, how much of the actual money that you're donating out there, how much of that is actually overhead versus how much is, what's the metric of lives saved? And so while we do give to nonprofits in local communities beyond GiveWell, our primary is to work through GiveWell. They are an aggregator of nonprofits from around the world, and they really help guide us with this data-driven approach to say, who are the most cost-effective nonprofit organizations there? And who are the ones that are saving the most lives that we can feel like as we're donating, that we're putting our dollars in the very best place? So we are data-driven. I love it because I'm a data-driven individual and I want to know that it's making an impact. And sometimes while well-intended, some nonprofits can also be not well-run. Just right. Like companies out there. And so GiveWell is our primary partner on that to ensure that we're putting our monies towards places around the globe that we can save people's lives.
It's a great place to take us to, Stephanie. Thanks so much for spending the time with me. We covered a tremendous amount of ground on today's show, starting back with the data-driven concept, which we just closed off here with confluent.org, and it actually helping the organization save lives. So I just want to thank you for joining me and spending all the time and sharing all the things. Like I said, we got a masterclass at a section or two on expansion sales, on the strength of the importance of the strength of a good product marketing team. So thanks for joining me today.
It was great to be with you. A lot of fun, and thank you very much for having me.
Terrific.